Scott to Sports Talk Chicago 38 podcast. My name is John Zaglua, and I'll be hosting today's show, and boy do we have a lot to get to today. We're talking about Jabari Parker and his recent signing with the Chicago Bulls, plus the untimely death of Ray Emerick, the former Blackhawks goalie and former Stanley Cup champion, and also Chicago Bears training camp starting in just under a week. All of that and more, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally. On Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JohnZax, and on Twitter at JohnZSports. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Single game tickets are available now. Call 708-489-BALL. That's 708-489-2255 to purchase tickets for their next home game. The Windy City Thunderbolts, celebrating their 20th anniversary here in 2018. It's quite unfortunate that we have to start off today's show with some bad news, but here it goes whether you're ready or not. The Chicago Bulls have signed Jabari Parker, and to this day, I don't understand why the Bulls are doing it, and you shouldn't either. It makes no sense that the Bulls have decided to pool their money, a $20 million per year contract for 2 years, although the second year is an option. But the point is, they're pooling their money over a guy who's already had two knee injuries and is coming off a torn ACL. Does that sound familiar to anyone? I thought it did. That's Derrick Rose, a Chicago native who did great here in Chicago for a couple of seasons before injuries took a toll on his career. And now the Bulls have decided to go after Jabari Parker, another guy here from Chicago who was approached by Nike and Gatorade back in high school for an endorsement deal. This guy was a big-time player at Simeon and a big-time player at Duke in college, and has done well in his first couple of years in the NBA. But after these two injuries, I'm quite skeptical of his future in the NBA, and I'm even more skeptical of his future here in Chicago. To put into perspective just how disappointed I am with the Bulls, I actually took to Twitter and ranted about it, saying, haven't the Bulls learned their lesson? Paying nearly $20 million per year for an injury-plagued Chicago native sounds eerily similar to the Derrick Rose saga. Jabari Parker is not worth $20 million, and he's not worth taking a chance on. Now, of course, immediately after that tweet was posted, I had people left and right criticizing me, claiming that Parker is actually part of the rebuild. Somebody even said, who are we supposed to sign that? Let me put this in simple terms for you guys. The point is, it's a rebuild. You're not supposed to sign anybody. That's the whole idea. Don't we remember from a couple of years ago when the Bulls were looking down and yet out of the blue they signed Dwayne Wade and Rajon Rondo? And at the time, everybody applauded these moves, but I said in one of my articles on this website that all the Bulls are doing is prolonging the inevitable. They don't want to start rebuilding. They still want people to show up to their games, and they still want guys who are big names who may not produce. And sure enough, the Bulls made the playoffs, went up 2-0 on the Celtics, then eventually got eliminated. And after that year, the Bulls finally decided that it was time to rebuild. At that point, I was so happy that the team decided to take a reality check and realize that the only way they're going to get good again is follow the 76ers model. Draft some young guys, develop them, home grow them, and eventually you'll have a superstar cast. And that's what the Bulls were starting to do. They drafted Lauri Markkanen. They drafted Jordan Bell, but traded him away, which, of course, to this day still makes no sense. But the point is, they drafted Markkanen. They developed Chris Dunn. They had some things going come year two, this year of the rebuild. Yet instead, they pull a stunt like this, sign Jabari Parker for $20 million a year for 2 years, with the second year being a team option. This is anti-rebuild. This is not what they're supposed to be doing. I don't understand it. Why can't people realize that the whole point of a rebuild is to homegrow players, lose many games, and get top draft picks in order to be relevant again? Unfortunately, Bulls fans and Bulls personnel don't understand what a rebuild takes. They think that after 1 year of losing and being mired in mediocrity, that they could just come back and at least break even and make the playoffs. That is not the goal right now. The team is supposed to be finding young guys to plan their future around. And I know Jabari Parker is just 23 years old, and he's only been in the league for 4 or 5 seasons, but the point is, this guy's been hurt twice, and you're paying him, allocating him, $20 million. I mean, is it only me that thinks about Derrick Rose when I hear about something like this? And another ridiculous argument that I've heard about Parker is that he's on the uptick and getting better. I don't think so, because if you look at his statistics from last season, you'll realize that actually, he's getting worse. Last year, after recovering from the injury and playing in 31 games, he shot a career-low 482 from the field, averaging only 12.6 points and 5 rebounds per game in 24 minutes. Now, here's the one stat that really has me concerned, because those numbers that I mentioned could always go up with more playing time and more reps and opportunities. But in that time, an average of 24 minutes per game, he averaged only 1.7 free throw attempts while making 1.3 of them. That is a career low, and it's a career low by far. Parker, in his 4 years in the league, has never averaged less than 2.5 attempts per game. So what does this tell you about Parker? It's that he's afraid, and mentally, he's not ready to come back onto the court and be the same player of old. Parker is simply afraid, and this is similar to Derrick Rose after he got hurt. Immediately when he came back, we saw a huge dip in his free throw attempts per game, and that's because he couldn't play his game anymore, which was drive to the basket, draw the foul, and shoot free throws from the line. Parker last year realized that it's also happening to him. He's not able to drive as much anymore, and because of that, he's not getting to the line as much. But in the grand scheme of things, what does this all point to? What does it all mean? Well, it means that the Bulls made a bad investment. They decided to ignore the numbers that I just brought up and sign a guy eerily similar to Derrick Rose. And correct me if I'm mistaken, everybody in Chicago loved Derrick Rose when he won the MVP and led the Bulls to a 62-win season. But after his injuries, everyone grew tired of his antics. Everyone was sick of the fact that he couldn't perform at the level that he could, and everyone couldn't wait for him to leave, which is what he did when he was traded to the Knicks. Do Chicago Bulls fans really want something like that again, where some big name is brought in to try and cure the woes of a losing season, yet in the end, he just gets hurt more and more, never sees the court, and when he does, he's not the player that he was advertised to be. Look, I know for a fact that everyone is sick and tired of that narrative. We saw it play out with Derrick Rose for years and years. So why even try and replicate it? That is what is puzzling to me. Instead of wasting their time with Jabari, the Bulls should be worried about Markkanen and his development in the sophomore season, Chris Dunn and his development in year number 3 for him, and Wendell Carter Jr.'s development as a rookie. All three of those situations are much more important to the future of the team than wasting their time trying to rehab Jabari Parker and get him back on the court. You know, someone said it best on Twitter. This Jabari Parker signing feels like a fan pick, and that's exactly what it is. Everyone remembers Jabari for his high school successes at Simeon, and remembers nothing but fondness and talent. But here's the catch. We're living in a reality that's 5 years after Jabari Parker's greatness at Simeon. And right now, he's an injury-plagued has-been who has a strong fan base in Chicago. And that's it. He's nothing special in the NBA. He never was before his injury, and he sure isn't right now. I just wish the Bulls would follow the process and the blueprint of the rebuild and stop spending ridiculous amounts of money for players who aren't going to pan out in the end. We'll see how Parker ends up fitting in, but one thing that I know for sure is that I'm not expecting anything spectacular. The bottom line is, once everyone gets over their giddiness about their signing, I hope they realize what the Bulls have just done. Because in the end, they're just prolonging their efforts to become a contender once again. Moving to the ice, we have two important pieces of Hawks news. One that's quite tragic, to say the least. Ray Emerick, who was with the Hawks during their championship run in 2013, and who had won the William M. Jennings Trophy that same year, has passed away at the age of 35 due to a drowning. Less than a week ago, Emery was found unresponsive during a swimming accident in his hometown of Hamilton, Ontario. He jumped off of a boat near the Leander Boat Club to go swimming, and friends called emergency services when he didn't resurface. Emery was 35 years old. Here's what the Hawks had to say about Ray Emery. The Chicago Blackhawks organization was deeply saddened to hear of Ray Emery's passing. We extend our heartfelt condolences to his family and friends. The Blackhawks will fondly remember Ray as a fierce competitor, a good teammate, and a Stanley Cup champion. The thing that some people may forget about Emery was just how dominant he was during that Stanley Cup winning season. In 19 games started, he went 17-1-0, giving up only 36 goals while posting a save percentage of .922. His goals against average was 1.94. He wasn't just some good player that year. He was an elite player who got NHL recognition via the Jennings Trophy. It's quite a shame that this happened to Emery, and we at Sports Talk Chicago extend our condolences to his family during this difficult time. In other Blackhawks news, the team just pulled off a massive trade involving fan favorite Marian Hossa. The team shipped Hossa, Vinny Hino-Stroza, and defenseman Jordan Oesterle to the Arizona Coyotes for Marcus Kruger, a former Hawk, Jordan Mileta, Mackenzie Entwistle, and defenseman Andrew Campbell. The Hawks also gave Arizona their third-round pick next season, while the Coyotes gave the Hawks their fifth-round selection. According to CapFriendly.com, the deal saved the Hawks $4.65 million in cap space. Definitely a lot to digest and absorb, but the main idea is that Marian Hossa was eating up too much cap space for the Hawks. Last season, Hossa said he wouldn't be playing due to a skin condition, but he still costed the team over $5 million. So although it's a shame that Hossa was forced to leave, you have to remember this move actually helped the Hawks. He's freeing up cap space, he's not on the payroll anymore, and the Hawks still got back some decent players. Marcus Kruger is a former Hawk who scored one goal and had 5 assists in 48 games last year. Mileta is a 23-year-old forward who has yet to play in an NHL game. Entwistle will be turning 19 soon, and he was just drafted by Arizona. And Campbell is a 30-year-old left-shot defenseman who has spent most of his career in the AHL but has a chance to make the team this season. And keep in mind, because this trade was made, the Hawks have more cap space and more money to sign up-and-coming stars like Nick Schmaltz and Alex DeBrincat, as well as the opportunity to go after significant free agents in the future. So I know departing with Marian Hossa is a problem for many, but in the end, the Hawks have set themselves up for the future and are ready to make moves come next year and the years to come. Finally, before we get to our special guest, let's talk about some Chicago Bears news. And one big piece of news coming out of Bears camp before it even begins. Roquan Smith, the Bears' first-round selection, has not reported to rookie camp, and this quote-unquote holdout could last as training camp begins. The Bears and Smith have two different ideas of how much he should be paid. Right now, the four-year value of Smith's contract is expected to be about $18.5 million, with his signing bonus near $11.5 million. But right now, they're in a bit of a conundrum. Smith wants more money and is not going to show up to camp unless he gets it. Personally speaking, I don't see why there's a big deal here. Smith is unproven. He hasn't even played a game in the NFL, and as we mentioned before the draft even took place, he's eerily similar to Leonard Floyd, and we've seen how that has worked out. So I don't think Smith should be here demanding more money when he hasn't proven anyone anything yet. Smith and the Bears need to put aside any petty differences and really work this out as quickly as possible. The last thing they both want is some sort of holdout or a long delay, because in the end, no one's benefiting from that. Meet in the middle, get the contract done, and report to camp. That's all I have to say to Roquan Smith. Let's put aside these petty differences, especially in money, and get back to the game itself, and stop worrying about contracts, signing bonuses, and yearly rates. In other news, Bears training camp starts this coming weekend, on July 21st at 8:15 a.m. It should be a fun time again this year in Bourbonnais, as expectations are heightened around the Bears, who hope to go at least 7-9 or 8-8 this season. Either way, it's a very fun experience, and I hope that through it, Bears players get more familiar with themselves while getting ready for the season's eventual start. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He was selected 5th overall in the 2001 NBA Draft. By 2002, he had won his first of two slam dunk contest championships, and 1 year later, his between-the-legs reverse finish captivated basketball fans everywhere. After his slam dunk success, he reinvented his game, leading the NBA in three-point field goals during the 2007-2008 season. Today, he is an avid golfer and fan favorite in Golden State. Please welcome Jason Richardson to the show. Jason, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show.
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
First off, Jason, I wanted to talk about your time with Michigan State collegiately, in which you won a national championship during your freshman year, then made it to the Final Four in your second season. How did that experience and success help prepare you for the NBA?
I think Coach Izzo prepared me well for the NBA just through hard work, dedication to the game, knowledge of the game. I think all those things helped me prepare for the NBA at the next level.
And sure enough, you were drafted 5th overall in the 2001 NBA Draft, and it's safe to say that your college success helped your stock in the draft. What was that experience like for you, being drafted in the top 5?
It was an amazing experience. It was something I wasn't thought I would happen. Didn't know that I was going to Golden State, didn't know I was a top 5 pick. It was just an amazing experience, and every time when the draft comes on, I just remember my experience going through the draft, getting my name called, being excited about the process, finally realizing that your dreams came true.
You know, once you made your NBA debut, you burst onto the scene, making the All-NBA Rookie First Team while being a go-to player for the Warriors. In 2002, you were selected to compete in the Slam Dunk Contest, and your performance was simply outstanding. How were you able to put on such a show with your dunking skills?
Well, I think, you know, going through the NBA dunk contest, it was just like I was a kid. I practiced really all the time as a kid growing up, being a dunker, you know, watching my favorite player, Dominique Wilkins, competing against Michael Jordan, and, you know, seeing guys like Sean Kemp and Kenny Skywalker, D. Brown, Harold Miner. It was just like me at the park just practicing dunks. So when I got the opportunity to do it, it was just like me being a kid again out there just fulfilling my dream.
You know, I have to ask, because that very next year, you pulled off the impossible by performing a between-the-legs reverse finish. How long did it take for you to master that dunk? How much planning and practicing was involved before you showed it off in front of everyone?
Well, it was a lot of planning going on. You know, my second year doing the dunk contest, I kind of ran out of dunks. A teammate of mine, Gilbert Arenas, always had these crazy ideals of doing dunks. And some of these dunks, I was like, Gilbert, there's no way in the world that could be pulled off unless you jump off a trampoline. He said, trust me, just try it. And I tried it one time, and I knew I missed it. But I knew it was going to be a dunk that I could do once I was in the dunk contest setting. The crowd was there, the anticipation, the adrenaline. I knew I could complete the dunk once I got to the NBA dunk contest. And when I did it in that dunk contest the second time around, that was the first time I actually completed that dunk.
Wow, that's so interesting. I wouldn't have known. You know, it looked like you had just practiced it for so long, and it looked so perfect that you wouldn't have thought that was the first time you actually made it.
No, it was the first time I actually made it, and I think I attempted again one time in China maybe a year or two later, and I could never complete that dunk ever again in my life. It was just one of those dunks that, you know, you're drilling and pumping, the crowd is want to see something spectacular. I needed a spectacular dunk to win the dunk contest, and I pulled it off.
And did you ever think at the time that it would become such a memorable piece of history? Because today, whenever they showcase the dunk contest or talk about it, that dunk and that highlight always seems to come up. Did you ever think that it would become so popular, especially after you finally pulled it off?
No, I didn't. You know, I just thought it was going to be a dunk. You can see if you go back and watch that dunk contest, and after I complete the dunk, I just had to sit there and wait and see, you know, what the crowd reaction was. And once I see my peers running towards me, that's when I raised my hand like, yeah, I knew I had a dunk that nobody seen, and I knew I won the dunk contest.
We're talking with Jason Richardson here on Sports Talk Chicago. Jason, after your dunking success, you had decided to reinvent yourself as a player, and it resulted in an NBA three-point field goal title. Why did you decide to do this, and take me through the process that you went through to master the three-point shot?
Well, it wasn't necessarily reinvent myself. I was always working on my shooting abilities. I know to have longevity in the NBA that you had to have more than athleticism, because it comes a day when your athleticism started to fade down. And going into the draft, I was working on my three-point shooter. I think if you go back even from Michigan State, from my first year to my second year, I improved as a three-point shooter, and it just got better and better every year. You know, I was taking 1,000 shots a day, 1,000 makes, actually. I was taking more than 1,000 shots. But just to make myself become a shooter and try to become a complete player, just the hard work and dedication, you know, learning from those days at Michigan State from Coach Izzo to become a better player every year was my dedication as an NBA player.
You know, you mentioned Coach Izzo a couple of times in this interview. How much did he mean to you, and how much did he mean to your success at the NBA level?
He means a lot to me. I mean, not just myself, just all the guys that go through Michigan State. It's a family atmosphere. It's a brotherhood. You know, just his knowledge of the game, his expectation out of you as a player and holding you accountable, but all at the same time, he always had your back. And, you know, those things I would never forget from Coach Izzo, all the things he has done for myself, for the program, for guys, you know, before me and guys after me. He was like a father figure away from home.
So your decision to focus on the three-point shot and become an all-rounded player really paid off, especially during the Western Conference Finals when you were on the Suns. With just 3.5 seconds left, you hit a clutch three to tie the game. What was that moment like for you, especially when doing it against the Lakers?
It was that whole moment was the highest point of my career and the lowest point of my career. it's on so many losing teams. You know, I finally made a team that was on the team that, you know, we went far. We liked each other. Everybody was on board. The only thing we worried about was winning. And when I had the ball in my possession, Coach threw the play up for me to take the shot. I missed the first one. I think Channing Frye got the rebound. And I knew I had to get it up. And it was actually pretty much a lucky shot because it banked it in from the top of the key. But it was just the highest point of my career, but also the lowest point because the next play, I gave up an offensive rebound to Ron Artest for them to win the game. So that's just the thrills of basketball, the ups and downs of basketball, but it's always going to be a memory I have.
You know, going back to your time with the Warriors, you were a part of the improbable 2007 team that beat the number one seeded Dallas Mavericks in the playoffs. Take me through that series, and how'd you guys overcome the odds to cause one of the greatest upsets in NBA history?
Well, we always knew that if we got Dallas, that we would beat them in a playoff series. Even before we got Steven Jackson, Allen Harrington in a trade, we always either played Dallas really close, lose by a couple of points, or, you know, beat them by a couple of points. But I think, you know, that year we got Steven Jackson, Allen Harrington, and of course we had Don Nelson, who basically gave Dallas their offensive schemes. They were using the same schemes Don Nelson had there. He'd known Dirk for years, so we knew all of Dirk's moves. But we knew that if we got them in a series, that we was going to win.
You know, looking at the Warriors today, did you ever think back in your time that you'd see the franchise make such a great turnaround and become this dynasty in which they are today?
No, I never would have thought that. You know, you always sensed that it was something special brewing there. Even when I was there my rookie year, we were getting, you know, 17,000-18,000 fans at the games, and we were barely winning 14 games a year. I knew if they would have got the right management in place, the right ownership in place, that was going to be a special place. But I never thought, you know, they would have won, you know, three championships so far, four championships, two back-to-back. you know, having this dynasty that, you know, almost becoming a lot of people hating them almost in a sense. But I mean, it's just so cool, and especially for the fans. The fans deserve it. They've been going through a losing streak for 15 years before I got there, before we finally made the playoffs. And now the fans is reaping what they sow, their dedication, their loyalty to that organization, and now it's finally paying off for those fans.
And what's ironic about all of that 2007 season, by the way, is that after the previous season, you wrote a letter of apology to all Warriors fans, promising them that you guys would make the playoffs the next season. I mean, you must be psychic, because everything that you claimed ended up happening. Why'd you write that letter, and did you ever think that what you wrote would end up coming true that next year?
Yeah, I knew what I wrote, I knew it was going to come true. I think that year, you know, we had Derek Fisher, had Baron Davis, Andre Bjelica was coming into his own, Monte Ellis was coming into his own. We just fell short. You know, I think Baron wasn't hurt, and that kind of threw our season off. And I just felt like we owe it to the fans. They showed up every night. They were expecting us to play hard. And they just showed so much loyalty to me that I felt that it was necessary for me to come out and tell them that our dedication is going to increase even next year more, and we're going to make the playoffs. I always felt that way, and, you know, we did. It was almost an impossibility to make it to the playoffs. We had to win, I think, 22 out of 26 games or 27 games, wherever it was. But we made the playoffs, and it felt great for those fans to actually finally get to the playoffs after, you know, 13 or 14 seasons getting out of it.
Going to 2015, you signed with the Atlanta Hawks, yet just 1 month after joining the team, you were forced to retire due to injury. What did it feel like to end your career, especially when, you know, you really didn't have a choice?
Well, I felt it was necessary at the time. I could have went on and continued to play, but I didn't want to be to the point where I'd not be able to play with my kids and enjoy my kids. And it would have been selfish of me to continue my basketball career and knowing I could have an injury that would stop me from walking or playing basketball with my kids. And I felt like I gave it everything I had to the game. I didn't leave anything behind. I think I emptied out the tank, and I think it was time for me to move on. It was a tough decision to make, but when I thought about it, you know, I had a daughter that was going to a junior in high school. I had two sons that were younger. I think it was time for me to go on and enjoy them and spend time with my family.
Did it bother you, though, even today, that, you know, you were kind of forced to retire due to the injury, or were you more so relieved that, you know, you made the right decision and that today you're spending more time with your family?
It wasn't a hard decision. I mean, right now, when I look back at it, I made the right decision. I felt like there was nothing else I could do. I don't have any regrets. I left everything on the floor. I think what was special about my career, even though it ended in Atlanta and my knee couldn't take on, the year before in Philadelphia, after being out for 2.5 years, I battled and I fought my way back to play 29 or 20-something games. So I felt like I gave everything I have. I kind of walked out on my terms, wasn't really forced out because of the injury. I still came back and played. But it let me know that I didn't end with the injury. I just couldn't go on anymore.
And on a final note, looking at today, I know you're quite an avid golfer, and you've said before that you'd like to join the tour. Is this something that we could be seeing in the future?
No, it's not. You know, that's every amateur goal is to go into a tour. Those guys are way too good, and my game is not that good. You know, I am preparing for some celebrity tournaments, trying to play in some of these celebrity tournaments, but I love the game. It's very challenging. It's almost, you know, bringing me back to my days in basketball, being a competitor. But I think the best part of this game is you competing against yourself. You know, it's little things that could turn your whole game upside down. And I think that's the challenge of the game and why I love it so much.
Jason, thank you so much for being here on the show. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
What an honor it was to have Jason Richardson on today's show. We talked about his great NBA career, his slam dunk contest championships, and his time with the We Believe Warriors team of 2006-2007. And I had talked to him after the podcast and had told him that as a kid, I would watch him all the time, whether it be in the dunk contest or on the Suns during late night games. He was such an electric player, and it was such an honor and a privilege to have him on today's show. And with that, it's time for our closing segment, the announcer's call of the day. And having Jason Richardson on today reminded me of one of the best moments of his career. At least that's what he said during the interview, when he hit a game-tying three-point shot against the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals. Let's listen in as the great Marv Albert makes the call.
Richardson is on it. The Suns have a chance to tie the game. Nash for three. Nash recovers. Richardson for the tie. Fry gets it. Richardson again for the tie. Yes! He breaks it home. Three opportunities for the Suns, and Jason Richardson goes last.
An amazing call, as always, by Marv Albert, and what a shot by Jason Richardson. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at Chi Talk Sports and hit me up personally on Instagram, Google+, and LinkedIn at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. A special thank you to Jason Richardson for being on today's show. I hope you enjoyed our conversation just as much as we both did. On a final note, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription box on the homepage. Simply type in your email, click the link in the confirmation email that's sent to you, and then you'll be subscribed. You'll receive email updates whenever a new article or podcast is posted. And finally, Sports Talk Chicago is now on iTunes and Google Play. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago and find our podcast. We'd really appreciate it if you can give us a rating or review, as well as subscribe. Every podcast from the 2018 calendar year is up on iTunes and Google Play. Check it out today. My name's John Zaglul for SportsTalkChicago.com. Thank you again for listening to the show today, and have a great day.